Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Ether. Today, I have Alexei Akunov on the podcast. Alexei is an independent Ethereum researcher and developer who has recently helped take charge of the Ethereum 1.x movement. Thanks for joining me today, Alexei.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, great. So, you know, before we dive into Ethereum 1.x and what it is, and, you know, to be honest, I'm very excited about this movement, and so I'm pumped for this conversation with you. Can you first give us a bit of a background about yourself and how you originally got involved with Ethereum?
Right. So I've been a software programmer for basically my whole career, since I was like, 18 years old. So I've didn't do any other kind of jobs. And so I got involved with Ethereum. I learned about it before it launched in 2014. So I did read the white paper before it launched. And I also, I was around at the launch. I even mined first. I mean, I mined 11 blocks in the very beginning with my computer. It was possible back then. So it was a very exciting thing. Yes, and then I transferred full-time into this kind of the Ethereum jobs in June 2017.
Nice. Yeah, there's no mining on laptops or desktops anymore. That's for sure. Those are the days, though, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess I'll preface this conversation with you had just you recently put a lot of pages up on ETHub, which was great. I very much appreciate that. So if people aren't aware of Ethereum 1.x, maybe load those up while you're listening to this and read and kind of follow along. You know, so I want to just kind of dive into Ethereum 1.x in the background. So there's, you know, there's obviously a lot of talk out there about Ethereum 2.0 and all the layer two scaling solutions that have been launching or are under development. But to be honest with you, I think this movement on the Ethereum 1 base layer on its own, well, let's put it this way. Ethereum 1.0 as is today is a great accomplishment and enables a lot. I think we can do a lot with it. So, you know, that's why I'm excited about this. So can you kind of start in explaining to the listeners exactly what this Ethereum 1.x movement is?
Yeah, so it's... I guess the short history, it goes like this. So in 2017 at DEF CON 3, I believe, Vitalik has given the closing note, closing presentation, and he essentially proposed that we will stop doing very kind of risky and breaking changes in Ethereum 1.0. And so it will become sort of safe and conservative. And instead, we will move all the innovation into the shards, which will be available at the Ethereum 2.0. And that sounded like a good idea. And everybody kind of agreed with that, with this approach. So then the Casper was still, at this point, the Casper was still planned to be actually deployed on Ethereum 1.0 to essentially to gradually transfer it from proof of work to proof of stake. So, but the important bit was that it was supposed to actually sort of evolve the chain into a proof of stake chain. However, that has changed in June 2018, where on one of the core developer calls, we sort of learned that now there was a pivot in the Casper and sharding research. First of all, the teams have been merged because they realized that they do a lot of the same research. But crucially, the most importantly, is that the Casper will be deployed in a separate chain. So that meant that the Ethereum 1.0 would not be transformed into the Casper as it was planned, but it would be kind of... So it is not clear how exactly, so what is going to be the fate of Ethereum 1.0? And I guess this is kind of where you can trace the birth of this movement. Like we haven't actually sort of talked about it a lot, but it was at that time, it was like the first seeds of this thoughts about, well, you know what, maybe we need to do something about it. It didn't seem all kind of very happy, so sort of, you know, we weren't sure what this actually means. So and then back in November, end of October, in November 2018 at DEF CON 4, so essentially there was the recognition that the Ethereum 1.0 has some issues, some performance problems, and we've got to solve them because we don't simply transition to proof of stake. We have to keep this chain for a while, for as long as we need to enable the Ethereum 2.0. So that's basically how it started.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I remember kind of seeing the discussion starting, but yeah, it seems just in the last, you know, couple months that it's really ramped up. You know, I know there's a lot of different critical components and kind of, I guess I've heard them described as working groups within this effort as well. And we're going to dive into, you know, in detail, but can you kind of explain what these different components or working groups are?
I'm not, originally we had created sort of four working groups because this is what you would usually do. I mean, as you would kind of approach this kind of movement and if you realize it's bigger than just one little project. So originally we split it into four kind of work groups, which one of them was state rent, another one was simulation and emulation, and a third one was chain pruning, and then the fourth group was EWASM, basically moving EWASM from sort of making it happen earlier in Ethereum 1.0 rather than Ethereum 2.0. But now I think we might need to reshuffle this a bit. We have to rethink these working groups. It hasn't happened yet, but it's on my mind at the moment. I think we have to restructure it somehow. For example, the state rent working group is essentially, I remember back at the DEF CON 4 that when we mentioned that there's a problem of the state growth, almost unanimously people said, well, the solution should be the state rent. But since then there was I mostly did some research on state rent, and some other people did as well, but then I realized that it's actually not the only thing, not the only solution, and I might actually regroup this a little bit and come up with a different characterization. I mean, what the different work streams should be.
Gotcha. Is that more because you think the kind of the initial four defined aren't as relevant anymore, or kind of what you're thinking there and why that needs to occur?
So first of all, they were these working groups were pretty different in terms of their complexity. So basically, the two most complex ones were the state rent and EWASM, and the kind of the ones that were didn't look like very complex, or they were more sort of one of which was not very well defined, I guess, was the emulation simulation group. And I don't think it's still very well defined. So I don't know how this is going to progress. And the chain pruning group was one person at the start. It was Peter Shilagi from Go Ethereum, but then Frederick from Parity has kind of taken the lead when we were at the workshop in Stanford. But at the moment, I think it needs to have a bit of a more kind of ecosystem research, I would say, and see what we're actually trying to do there. So sort of I would see that it's also not very clearly defined at the moment what this working group is supposed to do. So for the other two, it is more clear. For the two first working groups, it's more clear what they're supposed to deliver.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it kind of seems like maybe priority wise too, you could put effort on maybe the first and the second and then move on from there. And, you know, on that point, what does the timeline for ETH 1.x look like to you? I mean, is there, you know, an end goal to finish all of this, say within the next couple of years? Do you kind of see this as an ongoing effort, or what's your opinion on that?
Well, obviously we want to finish things. We would like to solve the most crucial, most serious problems. And this is what we actually did at the workshop in Stanford, is that one of the goals was to actually define what are the biggest problems are that we're trying to solve. And there are, for example, four biggest problems with the state, with the growing state that we kind of defined. And there are some more serious ones, some less serious. But essentially, the goal is that how can we solve or partially solve these four problems? And once we've done it, essentially, for the first working group is basically the job done pretty much, and you can do prioritize this afterwards. But for the EWAS and it's just kind of a, I would say this is less defined. It's more of the kind of meta feature. So, but I would say that I don't know how this is going to go, and I'm trying not to. So I'm trying very hard not to burn out, and because I know that the project of such complexity, if you take it too close to heart, you could basically just burn yourself out very quickly. So on one hand, I do want this to succeed, but on the other hand, I want to not be too much emotionally involved into it. So, I mean, a lot of people like to say that they're passionate about something, but actually I could see that like this particular project needs a lot of dispassionate approach to it. It's basically concentrated on delivery rather than on sort of passion.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And it's definitely not an easy problem to solve. So that's for sure. I'm sure your brain can burn out pretty easily when thinking about this. I want to shift to state rent, and you've mentioned it a lot already. And this is kind of, I guess, the one that gets the most focus on the ETH 1.x effort. And I guess just for those maybe not too aware of what this is, I mean, it's mainly related to, well, everyone always complains about the size of Ethereum nodes, right? There's a lot of misinformation out there that it takes 4 terabytes to run a full Ethereum node. That's not true. You know, it's more around 160 gigabyte. But if you're running a full archive node, if you say you run a block explorer and you might need a query on your chain or something like that, you know, I think we're up near 2 gigabytes. So when we're talking about state rent, it's kind of helping to appease this situation, which is a growing chain size. So, you know, I want to start very simple. When we're talking about state, even before we get to the concept of state rent, if we're just talking about the concept of state in context to Ethereum, what are we discussing and how large is that today?
Okay, so when we talk about state, it's essentially a combination of two things. It's all the existing accounts, but by accounts mean that accounts would have a public-private key pair with some address on the blockchain. Which already had or has or had some Ether on it. So that means that the nodes on the blockchain remember those accounts. Also the contract that would have been created, and also the contract storage. So it means that whenever a contract writes something into its variables, into this persistent variables, then it actually increases this contract storage. So these things, the ones that are currently accessible by transaction. So if you create a transaction, and the transaction can potentially access any part of that state. So it cannot access historical state. It cannot access, the block data, like of the past blocks, but it can access that state. So this is what we're talking about, the information which you can currently access from transaction. So depending on how you're counting, it will have a very wildly different numbers. So that's to count it in a unified way, I suggest counting number of accounts and counting number of storage items. For example, when I wrote my last kind of statistic blog post, it was February the 5th of this year. Number of accounts was 52 million and number of storage items was 165 million. And that in terms of gigabytes, like if you stored it in the most compact way, which I believe that this is how it's stored in TurboGeth, you probably come about 15 gigabytes of storage for this kind of state.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so just for people who are clear, you know, I know a lot of people run full nodes. I run one myself, and that is, if you're running one now, it's around 160 gigabytes. So state's 15. So what's taking up the other 145 gigabytes?
Well, actually, if you if you're running at Go Ethereum, then state is not going to be 15. It's probably going to be 60 or 70, or if it's parity, because the, as I said, the most compact representation is 15, but the most of the clients have not so compact. So essentially 60, 70 would be the state. Then about 70 gigabytes will be the block history. So it's actually all the blocks that downloaded. However, if you did the fast sync, you probably did, then you wouldn't have the whole history. So what else do we have there? So actually, let me just pull up my blog post, which I actually described there. So essentially what we have there is a block bodies, historical states, and receipts, and the current state. So four components. So current state, which I said that the most compact is 15 gigabytes. Then there's historical states. Then there's bodies of the blocks and the receipts. Basically, these are the four big components.
Okay, and state is what we're working on keeping in control. Is that right? The other aspects are not in scope right now.
Exactly. The other aspects are partially in scope of this chain pruning working group. So basically, chain pruning working group looks at other two components, which are the block bodies and receipts. And the historical states is currently out of scope for the Ethereum 1x. And one of the reasons for that is because it's currently already been pruned in parity and kind of pruned in Go Ethereum. It's basically only the current state is in scope for the state rent working group.
Okay, great. And yeah, just so people know, I'll link this blog post that you're discussing in the notes for this episode, so that people can reference it. So, you know, you mentioned, so I do want to dive into TurboGeth at the end of this, but for now, let's just take that example of state being between 60 and 70 gig on Geth and parity. Are we able to calculate this? I know it's grown a lot more recently, at least I think it has, versus say the first year, because obviously there's more people using Ethereum. Are there any models to kind of calculate this into the future? And, you know, do we have any estimates around what we think the size is going to be in, say, like the year 2022 or so?
So I tried to do some estimates, but the problematic bit about it is that the most of the growth has actually happened very recently. Like, for example, if you look at one of my metrics, which is the number of storage items, right? So these things, they add up about 20 million per month. So for example, back in November and beginning of November, the size of this, so this is the fastest growing bit of the state. So the storage items. So this is what the contracts are creating. So it was 140 million at the beginning of November. Beginning in February, it was already 160 million. So it grew about 20 million in 2 months. So we could project it that it, in a year, if it grows with the same rate, it will grow about 120 million per year, which is almost like doubling. So basically by November 2019, it will double since November 2018. So you could basically expect it to be about, so basically double by the end of this year. And if you project the same kind of growth, then it will be another, so 50, 60 gigabytes per year. So in 3 years, you basically get another 160 gigabytes or something. So essentially, it will be around 220 gigabytes, the entire state, in the Go Ethereum and parity. In TurboGeth, it's probably going to be about 40 gigabytes or something, or 50 gigabytes.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's good to know. So about double year. And that's assuming that usage stays the same, but I guess in thinking about it, blocks are pretty much full. So can we outpace that growth? Like layer two solutions add to the state, or could that pick up even though blocks are pretty much full at this point?
Well, it's sort of, this is the analysis that I haven't done yet. So what I wanted to do is that to figure out how much of the current block gas limit is actually spent on expanding the state. So So how much of the 8 million gas in each block is actually gone into the creation of new accounts or creation of new storage items. So I haven't done this analysis. And this is where, if we do that analysis, then it will be kind of clear to us. So let's say that imagine if we do not increase the block gas limit for a second. And then what is the maximum acceleration in terms of state growth? Depending on how much of it is happening right now. So I don't know. So I haven't done this analysis yet. So, but the rate could theoretically still increase. So even though we don't increase the block gas limit, it doesn't mean that the rate of state growth will stay the same, because it might be people will use state more and then you use other operations less, or things like reduction of the gas price of certain operations will free up more space in the blocks for state expansion, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That'd be a cool analysis to see, because I mean, we've seen a dropping uncle rate, and I've seen some discussions around raising the gas limit now from, it's currently at 8 million per block. But of course, there's repercussions on the state side, it's on the other side of that. So that would be a pretty cool analysis to see, so that everybody could understand the impact of raising the limit.
Yes, and to this question about a block size, gas limit. I've been writing about it a little bit last year. So essentially, we would like to increase the block gas limit, but at the same time, we would need to kind of put some brakes on the state growth by potentially, let's say, make some of the state expanding operations more expensive. But it has its own kind of complexities. So these things are not so trivial, unfortunately.
Yeah, definitely. So, I think that's a good transition. So we've talked about state and where we're at now and how it grows and what aspects it, or what part of that contributes to the size of people running nodes on their own machines. So, you know, the term itself may be a bit obvious, but then what is state rent? So how are we looking to control this state size?
Well, initially, so there are actually, so the state rent is only one possible way of controlling the size of the state, and it's probably one of the most obvious ones, and that has been proposed many times before and back in 2015, I guess. And the idea is that when somebody is expanding the state, which means that they create an account or they create a storage item, they do not simply do one-off payment to expand the state, but then they also have to pay some upkeep. So essentially, they will have to contribute more, let's say, fractions of ether each block. They don't have to do the transaction each block, but there has to be enough balance available to cover essentially the rent, which is a recurring kind of payments. These payments don't happen like every block, of course, but they happen whenever something is modified. But the idea is that essentially the main idea behind it is that if we assume that things on the blockchain are not really useful forever, so there's only a few things that are actually useful for like forever. So most of the things that come and go, and their usefulness has some kind of limitations, simply because the other concepts have been developed or contracts have been migrated, and so things change constantly. So instead of keeping the old stuff around, things that people don't need anymore, we essentially make sure that these things are getting removed. And so this is the tricky question, because you would like to remove the old stuff, but how do you figure out that the stuff is old and nobody use it? And one of the ways to do it is basically to introduce the rent, which is basically mean if somebody is actually actively preparing to subsidize this particular part of the state, then it means somebody needs it. But it has some, unfortunately, it has some other kind of side effects.
Yeah. I mean, anytime someone, you know, deploys a contract or even submits a transaction, right, they're putting a cost on the entire network because all the nodes have to download it and they have to process it and all that. So to your point, a lot of this stuff, especially on the contract side, maybe doesn't need to be out there forever, especially some of the state. Now we'll get into the complexities of how to potentially backfill this into the current chain, but you mentioned kind of how the mechanism of rent would work. So is it basically, or is the thought now someone would say deploy a contract, and then did you say they would just hold funds in that contract and kind of they would be automatically taken out to pay the rent? And kind of what would happen if say that those funds ran dry and they weren't paying the rent anymore?
So the current idea is that so the rent would be charged. And by the way, we should discuss there. I'm currently pivoting slightly from this idea, but I'm going to describe you what was in the proposal number three, which might be already out of date, but I'm still for consistency. I'm going to describe this. So essentially, non-contract accounts and contract accounts are being charged rent, and that means that whenever account is modified, for whatever reason, then we calculate what was the due since the last modification, like, because we can figure out when was the last. So there's a special field which tells us when was the last rent calculation. So we figure out how much is due, and then we try to basically collect this rent. And we first trying to collect it from the special field, which contracts will have, which is called rent balance, which is separate from the balance. And if it's not enough, then we try to collect it from the regular balance. If that's still not enough, then basically regular balance becomes negative. And so when the negative balance becomes negative, then so any transactions which accesses at this which in any way, this contract or an account in any way, would cause it to be evicted from the state. Which means it's basically for the non-contract accounts, they will be simply removed from the state. And for the contracts at this, in the proposal number three, the idea is that we don't completely remove it, but we basically leave behind some kind of hash, which essentially a commitment to the state of the contract before the eviction.
So would that mean they can restore it at a point if they started paying it again?
Yeah, so the idea is that, as I mentioned, that the rent is a bit of a, so essentially the rent is a bit of a crude mechanism of figuring out which things are not needed anymore. So people can make mistakes, so they can forget that they need to pay rent, and then the stuff gets evicted and they basically need to get it back because there was a mistake. So yeah, these hash is essentially allowing people to restore the contract in exactly the same state as it was before the eviction.
Gotcha. And you're mentioning proposal three. Is there somewhere that people can go to see the different proposals?
There are three of them. And there's one, there's two, and three. And they were all, so one, number one was suggested, I was published in November 2018. Then there was a second one, which was published in middle of January. And third one, which was published in February. So I'm currently working on number four, which is again the rework. So they're currently on my in my GitHub. I can give you a link for the repository. But also, every time I publish them, I create the topics on Ethereum Magicians Forum and Ethereum Research, because some people prefer one or the other. So I'm looking for feedback. And so I don't get a lot of feedback, but the amount that I get is usually enough to write the new version.
Nice. Yeah, I frequent both of those forums. I definitely suggest people go out there. There's a lot of good discussion. I know people like going to social media these days for discussions, but I highly recommend going to ETH Research and Ethereum Magicians Forum. So, you know, you mentioned it's gone through a couple iterations now. Like, how do you, an extremely complex topic. Like, how do you determine what you think is kind of the final proposal? I mean, and obviously the community and a lot of other developers are kind of included in that, but how do you think we come to, hey, this is the proposal that we should move forward with?
Well, I don't have basically the criteria for when this is final. Maybe it's never going to be final. But at the moment, we're trying to work towards some deadlines, which I don't necessarily agree this is the good way of working like that, because you might actually try to implement something which is not really good. So I know that there is a deadline for to specify the changes for the Istanbul hard fork, let's say in May. But at the same time, I think, you know, I don't worry about this too much. I don't get sort of anxious that we have to get everything done in May, because these things take time. And if I need more time, we need more time. We will just take more time. So, but at the same time, I don't know. I mean, what I tried to do after the proposal number three, I have tried to do a bit of a project planning to sort of list out what are the things that we have to do to implement it, and not just in development, means not just in terms of development, but also kind of one of the things that I put there was the ecosystem research, which means that somebody actually has to go and look at all the major contracts that exist out there and figure out how they're going to be affected, what is there going to be the rewrite strategy. Somebody has to go and talk to these people and things like that. So this is, you know, when you write it down, like all these things that they need to happen, it just becomes so enormous, and you're just like, oh, you know, either I need tons of money or I need tons of time.
Yeah.
Or both. So this is one of the reasons why I kind of trying to pivot a little bit up from this in the version 4, which I can tell you about if you'd like, because it's got some very different ideas in there.
Yeah, definitely.
So essentially, with the version 4, for the version 4 of the proposal, I'm trying to do the sort of hybrid between the rent and the stateless clients. You might have heard of the concept of stateless clients before.
Yep. Yeah. Could you explain it maybe quickly to those that aren't aware?
So essentially, the idea is that in Ethereum, the good thing about the state is that so the state is essentially Merkleized. It means that the whole state is represented as a Merkle tree, and then it gets hashed at each block, and the hash of this state is included into the each block header. Essentially, each block header has a commitment to the entire state. And the reason is really good because you could produce the proofs, which we call Merkle proofs, which is essentially like a string of hashes, which basically can satisfy you that the particular piece of data is in fact part of the state. But it can also, it cannot only do that, but it can also, if you produce a couple of proofs, it can also satisfy you that a certain modification on the previous state turns it into the state within another hash. So essentially, let's say that at the block 300, we have root A, and in block 301, we have root B, state root B. And so we could actually provide a proof that if you execute all the transactions on this block, then the state root will transition from A to B. So in order to prove it, you don't actually need to show the entire state. You only need to show the parts that have been touched by this transaction and their corresponding Merkle proofs. So the idea of the state of clients is that it's also been introduced by Vitalik in November. Yeah, in the same presentation where he said that Ethereum needs to be safe and conservative. He's also showed the slide with the stateless clients, which essentially, together with the block, so currently the block is essentially a list of transactions mostly, but in the model of stateless client, it will also include some proofs, and the proofs will essentially be the data that the transaction is touching together with what it's modifying. So, and that proof should satisfy anybody that this is what the transaction is doing. And so in order to process this transaction, you don't actually need the entire state. You just basically need these proofs, and that's it. So you can do that. Or if you do have the entire state in your database, the benefit to you is that you can simply look at what transaction is doing and modify your database without trying to recompute any of the Merkle hashes, because everything is already proven to you. So you don't actually need to store this Merkle Patricia tree in memory, which which helps quite a lot, and it eliminates quite a lot of performance problems. So the biggest issue with this approach is that the blocks are likely to become much bigger.
Interesting. So to switch to a stateless client, then the storage of the blocks themselves would get bigger.
Yes. Not only that, but also the bandwidth will require more bandwidth. So essentially, together with the blocks, you will have to shuffle the shift around the proofs around the network. So, but the interesting dynamic is that so what I'm trying to do now is that before I publish this proposal, before I write it, actually I'm trying to do the proof of concept, which is actually going pretty well. So instead of simply trying to roughly estimate how big these proofs would be, I'm actually trying to implement the proof of concept of the stateless client, essentially trying to produce these proofs to figure out how they're going to be encoded in a block, and actually try to execute the transactions with the proof to make sure that everything is working, so that then I can analyze how big these things are going to be for the current blocks, for the blocks that we already have. We look at this and we'll say how bigger the blocks will become and how much benefit this is going to give us. So I'm currently like working through the blocks. I'm going to block like 400,000. So slowly working my way through the blocks.
That's very interesting. So if we were to, go to stateless clients, as we mentioned, part of what a node's storing today are the blocks themselves. So essentially the 60 gigabytes of state would go away. Maybe the blocks would get bigger. Why is that better? Like, are we just shifting from state to block size? Does that become easier to manage?
So what becomes better, first of all, the only nodes that actually need in this model, the only nodes that they actually need the entire state are the miners. So because they are going to be the people who are going to produce these proofs, right? So the production of these proofs will require that access to essentially entire state. But once the miners have produced these proofs and they distribute them together with the blocks, all the other nodes, they either don't need the state at all, so they don't actually have to store it, or if they choose to have the state still, then they don't need to it becomes very, very efficient for them to process transactions. So the transaction processing essentially means running the transaction pretty much all in memory. So because the entire proof is probably going to fit in memory, and the transaction itself, everything just goes in memory, no disk IO, and in the end they basically proven to themselves that transaction is correct and this is the result, and then they just simply do the write in a database, which basically can be asynchronous and super, super fast. So basically they update a database and they just move on to the next block. So essentially the only nodes which will kind of suffer from this change will be the mining nodes which are producing the block, but everybody else will be much more efficient in the whole network, apart of course from the bandwidth. So they will need to require much more bandwidth.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you mentioned in proposal 4, do you think stateless clients could replace having the need for state rent completely, or do you think it's still kind of a hybrid approach?
I think we probably try to do the hybrid approach. So one of the things that I'm going to do in my data analysis, I'm going to do a separable. So that by separable, I mean that I will calculate how much bandwidth do we need for stateless client for the actual accounts, for the contract accounts and for the non-contract accounts, and how much of the bandwidth we need to prove the contract storage. So because you can treat them as to do two separate things, right? You can, do rent on one of them and do the stateless client on the other one. For example, the interesting hybrid approach would be that you charge the rent on all the accounts, but you don't charge the rent on the storage, on the contract storage, which is basically the biggest issue with the ecosystem research, because your rent will be proportional to the size of the contract. So if you do the hybrid with the stateless client, you say, okay, I'm going to do the proofs for all the modifications of the contract storage, but not for the actual accounts, and I will do the rent on accounts. So I will try to, essentially what it will try to do is it will try to reduce the or constrain the number of accounts in the system, but it will not try to constrain the size of the contracts themselves. Instead, it will put the burden on the miners to produce, to basically have a bigger stake and produce these proofs. In this data analysis, I want to do them separable so we can analyze what is going to be the bandwidth requirement for if we do the hybrid approach, if we do the full approach, and things like that.
Gotcha. So if you shift rent then from, say, contracts to accounts, I mean, obviously then that's going to impact a lot more people because most people are, you know, dealing with simple accounts. How would that work? Like if someone's not, you just have your basic user with 10 ETH in their account and they aren't aware of rent and they don't pay it, like what would happen? How do you make sure those funds aren't lost?
So for them, it's very simple. So if we don't have a contract, then the rent is pretty much, it's almost trivial because the accounts themselves, they don't actually have any interesting information apart from essentially their address and their balance, right? So when you evict them, so essentially you still charge the rent and the rent gets subtracted from the account little by little, but it's probably going to be very small amounts. Let's say, whatever, 20 cents per year, something like that. And then if the account runs out of funds, then it gets evicted. And it gets evicted entirely because there is not really much interesting in it. So it's got zero balance. Apart from the fact that it had some nonce in there, there's nothing interesting left. So if somebody then wants to keep using this account again, so they would need to just put some more ether in it, and it will basically just come back. You know, you don't actually need a special restoration procedure. So the only tricky bit there is about the nonce. We know that. So the nonce essentially is not only used for the prey protection, but also for, so if you do the create, if you create the contracts from the non-contract accounts, then the address of the contracts is calculated using the nonce of the account. So nonce is important from that regard. So the in the current proposal is that we want to change the way that the new accounts are created. So at the moment, if you create a new account, fresh one, like if you just drop some Ether into some account and then you try to use it, like send some transactions out of it, the nonce always starts from zero. So in the proposal number three, the nonce will start from not zero, but from bigger number, which will be the total number of transactions that happened so far in the network. So that will ensure that there will be no clashes of nonces.
Okay. Yeah, and it makes sense that the funds would just come out of the account. So just to be clear, in the current proposal, rent would be charged not only to contracts deployed, but also basic accounts?
Yes, on everything. So in the control, basically the current proposal number three is essentially eventually, step by step, we get into the rent will be charged on everything. Everything that is stored in the state will be charged. But the hybrid proposal with the state stateless clients, if it's viable, if it's proven to be viable, which it might not, then the we will see where the line will be between them will be essentially.
Okay. Yeah. And going back a little bit for the stateless clients, I mean, when you're talking more larger blocks that require more bandwidth, can that have an impact on the uncle rate?
Of course, it will probably increase the uncle rate. Well, I wouldn't say probably, it will actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's interesting. There's a lot going on for sure between proposal three and four, it sounds like.
And that's why it's, if we talk about the timelines, I initially was a bit anxious about the timelines, you know, because, you know, there's only like, now we talk, it's March already, right? And if we need to completely specify it by May, I would say it might not be possible. And I was a bit worried about it in the beginning, but now I'm probably not that much worried because I just know that if things take time and you have to do them properly. And besides, we actually have a bigger problem at the moment, which is not solved by rent, but it could be solved by rent, but the biggest problem can actually be solved without the hard work.
And what is that? I was going to ask you what ETH 1.x things can be solved without a hard fork?
Oh, without a hard fork, yes. So there are a couple of things that could be solved without hard fork. So the four big problems that we recognized that are the problems with the big state size, and these are the only performance problems. We basically decided not to go into the state cost of storage, because it's very quickly becomes the argument that we cannot basically support. I mean, because there's so wide variety of the prices and stuff like this. So we're going to talk about performance only. So what are the biggest performance implications of the large state? So number one at the moment is, well, from our point of view, is the in some situations the sync, the snapshot sync starts failing. And this is what I'm describing it. I've described it in my series of blog posts as well, and it has a little picture, series of pictures, which kind of explains you what it means, how this could potentially happen. And luckily, this problem, so the what it means is that it, if the snapshot sync fails, if it happens more and more, then it will be harder and harder for the new nodes to join the network. So they will basically have to restart again and again, like waiting for hours to sync. And then doesn't work, and then you have to retry and retry and try. So this luckily could be solved by introducing more sophisticated, more advanced syncing mechanism. This is what we are currently working, and not only we. So there's multiple groups actually working on this because it's been now recognized as one of the most important problems. And luckily, it could be solved without hard fork. So there's different names for it. I think in the Go Ethereum, it used to be called Leaf Sync, and in the Parity, it was called Fast Warp Sync. Then there is this Trinity team has come up with the Fire Hose Sync, and then there is also another one that was called the Red Queen Sync, which is but you will see it very shortly. There will be like a blossom of this sync protocols.
Nice. So those will be implemented into current clients just to make syncing faster and cheaper, essentially.
No. It's actually not about speed. It's about this particular bit is about the actual success of the sync.
Okay.
To make sure it does not fail, even though you have to still wait for like a long time to sync, like hours. At least it should not fail. So you shouldn't wait for nothing, right? It shouldn't happen like you wait for 9 hours to sync, and then in the end it tells you, oh, sorry, it didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. I've run into that before too.
So, and then the second problem is the actual duration of the sync. So if we solve the problem of the sync failures, then we still have the fact that you have to wait for hours to sync is not nice. And this is where the stateless clients would have the biggest impact, because actually in most use cases, unless you're running the block explorer or a miner, for most use cases you could actually start processing the block and requesting the state straight away. So as your node tries to sync, at the same time, you can already process blocks, you can verify them, and you can, do most of the stuff. So you can send transactions and stuff like this, because you already, I mean, for transactions, you will still have a kind of query bit of the state, but it's kind of almost like a going into light client territory, but without the complexity of the light client protocol.
Gotcha. Yeah, I welcome all optimizations to the current clients out there. So those all sound good to me, especially, without doing a hard fork too. That makes things easier, right?
Well, the stateless clients will require a hard fork.
A stateless will. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, because because it will have to be consensus change. Because also the other thing we will have to do is that if we do introduce it, then the cost of reading and writing the storage will actually increase, because you will have to charge people for depending on how many times, how many unique items a transaction reads, for example, from the state, and how many unique items it writes, because it will result in more proofs. Let's say if it reads 10 elements from the state, so you will have to produce 10 proofs, right? And so that increases the size of the proof. So these transactions will have to pay more, much more than now for this. So, and this is where sometimes I think that the stateless client will actually sort of demonstrate that if you want sort of unlimited storage, it will be pretty expensive. And so if you also introduce a new type of storage, which actually is heaven rent, but much cheaper to use, then people will naturally migrate to the rented storage because it won't be like, it will be cheaper to use, but it will vanish if you don't keep up the payments.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So I guess my last question on state rent is, you know, I'm talking about this and you've mentioned it a few times. Obviously it seems like the most complex thing here, as far as like a coordination across the whole chain, is the fact that many deployed contracts would have to be rewritten. What's the scope of this rewrite? Is it everybody? And kind of what would the process look like to somebody that maybe has a dApp deployed out there? Let's choose Maker for an example. Do they have to rewrite everything and redeploy?
So most of, yes, the short answer is yes. However, it does, so the second answer is that when they have to do it and like how long they would they have, it does change from one proposal to another. Because in the very first proposal for the rent, the contracts will be, so it's like what I call pure rent is basically you just start charging rent and everything. And in this case, the contracts become, most of the contracts which exist today, they become vulnerable to this sort of dust griffin attack, which means that anybody could inflate their storage and make them pay more rent, which is the griffin attack. In the for subsequent proposals, this problem has been addressed by introducing, first in the second version, it was a lockups. In the third version, it's prepayment. So essentially, if somebody wants to mount a griffin attack, they will actually have to prepay. So whenever you inflate somebody's storage, you actually have to prepay some of the rent, for example, for the 1 year or something. So it means that the griffin attack still happens, but the effects of it, this attack, are only starting after 1 year. And they are clearly visible to the owner of the contract. Let's say that if your contracts get griefed, right, with the prepayment, so with the version 3 state rent, then you will see that somebody is actually trying to grief you, and you will have 1 year, let's say, to do something about it, which is kind of nice, right? That yeah. You still have some time. But if we do the hybrid, if we find it is viable to do the stateless clients, and we do the hybrid approach, then it will be actually the way that you don't have to rewrite your contract, but you probably want to, because if you stay with the stateless clients mechanism, then it will be much harder, much more expensive for people to use it. So you would rather rewrite it and then go for cheaper rented storage than use the kind of the old unlimited storage, but it will be much more expensive to use.
Gotcha. So at least it's not like an immediate, hey, you need to do this now. There's a little bit of runway there.
This is why I kind of would prefer this mechanism, because it removes this burden of like us trying to go around, run around and find everybody, like making sure everybody's okay.
Yeah.
We just basically give them economic choice. You know, you can stay with where you are, but it will be more expensive. You can move to this new system, which is kind of cheaper, but cheaper in the medium term. So you're, you know, over the time, of course, you're going to pay some more, but essentially things will become, so the rented storage will become easier to use and also cheaper to use.
Yeah, that seems fair. You know, how do you see, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of talk about Ethereum 2.0, and the ideal goal, I think, would be to fully transition over there at a point hopefully in the near future. You know, we won't even have state transitions until phase 2, though. So we know, like, we're not going to see any big movement over there until phase 2 is launched. How do you see the transition happening? And do you think that the Ethereum 1.0 chain will stay around forever, or do you think it'll eventually just kind of burn out?
I'm not sure about this. So it's probably going to happen when I'm already kind of retired, if it does go away. So you probably know that as well. So if you worked in some kind of traditional corporations with the large IT systems, right? So what happens very often in these places is that you have some very successful system which gets old, but it's been used by a lot of people and generates a lot of revenue. And then people realize it's actually too old and we want a new system, and they start building a new system. And then there's this huge, humongous, normally there's a humongous migration project, right, that people have to manage. I mean, I've seen so many of them. And they normally take much longer than people realized from the start. So they take like 10 times longer than people think they would.
Yeah.
So that's why I think, I mean, of course, we are working in a completely different space, but still this experience of seeing these migration projects taking much longer kind of tells me that we might be a bit too optimistic about how quick this migration is going to happen.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think people always kind of overestimate how fast these things are going to happen, and or I guess underestimate is what I mean. They always take longer than they seem to.
And another thing that happens if you think about those projects in a traditional kind of companies, is that you end up running both systems for a considerable amount of time. Because migration takes that long, you basically end up with two different teams, almost different teams, which basically just support their own projects, and they kind of trying to migrate one to another, but essentially both still have to be kept alive. And I sort of see this is going to happen with Ethereum in some ways. We basically have two Ethereums at least for some time. Like, we'll have to keep Ethereum 1.0 alive, and 2.0 will start being used, but for some period of time, and probably it's going to be a long time, we'll have to do both.
Yeah. I do think it'll stick around a little bit longer than people expect, but eventually the benefits of the 2.0 chain will catch up to everybody, and we'll see a transition over. But the question is just how long is that? And that's definitely one of the goals here, is to make sure the 1.x chain can survive forever. And there's a lot of good people working on 2.0, and it's definitely going to happen. But we've been working on proof of stake for years now, so we got to make sure that 1.0 can survive, if there's more delays in 2.0. So that's one of the reasons I like this effort. What does the resourcing look like? How many people are working on ETH 1.x? And is there any way that the community can help, maybe through donations? Are you guys on Gitcoin grants, or how is it funded right now?
So currently we have, the funding is only in a very kind of initial stages, but at the moment from my personal point of view, there's myself working on this almost full time. And as Andre was, he started working with me really recently, since February this year. So we are being supported by Ethereum Foundation, although we're not basically employed by Ethereum Foundation. It's through the contract. So this is good. There are other parts of the project which currently, I mean, this is one of the reasons I was trying to do this project plan, is that to try to find what do we actually need to fund. And so there was this big thing, which was like ecosystem research, which I was very worried about, which, because it could turn up costing millions, like millions of dollars. And I was worried about who is going to give such money. So the things that the other groups are doing, I mean, ETHWASM group is currently part of the ETH 1.x group. And I don't know how they fund it, but I'm assuming that it's also Ethereum Foundation funding. The smaller things like the sync protocols, they're also mostly funded either by Parity or by Ethereum Foundation. So it's most of the biggest funder at the moment. We do have a lot of sort of offers from other people to help us. But at the moment, we have to specify exactly what this help needs to be. And this is hard, because a lot of people basically would help you if you tell them, okay, so tell me what it is and tell me how much do I need to give you, what work needs to be done, who has to do it, and how much money does it cost. And this is where they can give you. But like, if you come up with a very vague kind of idea, like, oh, maybe we kind of need to do this and that, so that is less likely to succeed. So I think we're still, I mean, because the way it all started very quickly, and I personally, I'm trying to kind of delegate as much things as I can, but at the same time, not to fall behind in terms of the deadlines and stuff like this. So it's unclear to me how exactly people can help, and I'm welcoming ideas, but it's not easy to even say how people can help you. I don't know if it makes sense.
No, it does. I mean, it's still in the scoping phase too, so.
And at the same time, I don't really want to have a kind of a huge project on my hands. At the same, it's something that I'm not really enjoy doing. So I don't want to turn into a project manager who basically kind of having a budget and just rolls over the spreadsheets and things like that. So I...
Yeah, no, for sure.
You probably understand me, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and some problems aren't, you can't just throw more brain power at it and fix it, right? I kind of feel like this is one of those problems. Like it requires very kind of focused and detailed research, and eventually it will get there, but it just takes time.
Oh, I just had an idea. So the one of the ways that I think I'm trying to sort of kind of help it is to try to reshape the whole the Ethereum change process. People call it the EIP process or whatever they call it. And to try, so this is what I was talking about at the last core dev calls, is trying to essentially make it more inclusive, not in a way that, you know, that we're not letting people to do stuff, but by this I mean to increase number of people who can actually look at the changes, who propose the changes and review them and implement them. So I think it's already happening, but basically this is a prerequisite for such big project as Ethereum 1.x to really thrive, is to have a lot of people who can not just throw out ideas, but also can implement them, who can write tests for them, who can review the changes, who can give feedback and things like this. So I really hope that the part of this movement is not simply technical, but it's also about like growing growing up essentially this process, which is a bit at the moment it's a bit too restricted. Like it has a very low bandwidth.
Yeah, that would be good. And you mentioned tests. We definitely need some good test cases around this stuff.
Well, the thing is, so the test cases normally would be, the way to do it would be to, as I said as well on the call, is that to require any AIP to actually have a proof of concept implementation, and not simply to prove that it sort of works, but also the proof of concept should help you to actually generate the test in the format that is required for other clients to test it. Because otherwise we will have these things always where one or two people in the end write all the tests and try to, you know, it does slow down things quite a lot, as you probably remember.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that makes sense, expanding that. So I guess just kind of the last thing I want to talk about was TurboGeth. You mentioned it a few times. You know, I know this is a project you were working on. Are you still working on this? And I guess for people that aren't aware, you want to explain it a little bit?
Yeah, so TurboGeth is essentially, it's my take on the Go Ethereum, which is essentially started more than a year ago. And so I started optimizing it, trying to see like how can we make it faster. And then I shifted into essentially changing the database layout. So the TurboGeth is the main difference. It's mostly Geth, but the main difference is that it stores the data in a different format. So, and it turns out to be much more compact format than the Geth. So it stores things in the very sort of intuitive flat format. It's like a key value pairs instead of the hash tree. And at the moment, it's under development. I mostly use it for as a sort of workhorse for lots of analysis and the proof of concept. For example, the one that I do for a stateless client at the moment, the TurboGeth is essentially the way I do it, because I've already written a lot of stuff that helps me to do this analysis and experimentation. So I'm using it as a workhorse, and also it's able to because of this efficient data layout, it can actually retrace transactions like 50 times quicker than the Geth can. So I can do lots of interesting data analysis in a shorter time.
Do you think you'll release it? Will this be something that end users can use at a point, or do you think you'll continue to use it?
This is the hard question, because I would like this to be used by people, but at the same time, I don't really know how to get there. I wish I had more time to write docs about it or to get people more involved, but it's easier said than done. You know, it's just all these kind of initiation efforts require more time, and I probably not very experienced in kind of how to grow this, you know, open source communities around the project. So I wish I could do that, but I haven't succeeded so far. I mean, because I know that I'm not going to be able to do it on my own. I need a lot of contribution, you know, to be able to release it and successfully maintain it, but I haven't found a way to do it.
Yeah, this sounds like where you need help more than anything, right? We were just talking about on the 1.x side, maybe it's TurboGeth where we need it. I mean, I'd definitely like to talk to you about this offline and maybe try and push this forward. And, you know, Gitcoin Grants is doing a lot of good things for raising a lot of funds for teams building open source, you know, solutions that need a little funding to help get off the ground. Maybe that could be something here too. But, you know, I'm a fan of this project. I've been following it for a little while, so it'd be great to see it get out there in the wild someday. I'd love to get my hands on it.
Okay, cool. Yes. No, it is actually open source. I mean, but it's very hard to find information about it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think this has been an awesome conversation. I'd really enjoyed it. And, you know, I'm sure over the coming years, we can have some follow-ups and check in on the state of how things are going. But I really appreciate you joining the podcast.
No, thank you for your time as well. Thank you. It was brilliant.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.